From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I once had a conversation with a coworker about a boss. It had been revealed that our boss was an atheist. And my coworker wondered about that person's morality, not because of anything that person had or hadn't done, but because that person was an atheist. How could an atheist have a moral code? Asked my coworker. What would they base their behavior on in the absence of a belief in God or a belief in the promise of heaven and the threat of hell? Well, atheists and agnostics would tell you that their worldview is one of acceptance, tolerance, and morality. Given that the United States is among the most religious nations on earth and one of the most religiously diverse, life here must be uncomfortable for those who profess a disbelief in a deity. Imagine being on their side of the fence and having to deal with professions of faith, from prayers at football games and civic club meetings to holiday displays to churches on every corner to stores being closed on Sunday in some places for religious reasons to "In God We Trust" on the money. Some of that may be trivial and go unnoticed, but being on the outside of such an emotional and dynamic issue cannot be easy. Today we're going to look into the lack of religious belief of atheists and agnostics and examine what it is they do believe. We're joined by Ellen Johnson, the president of American Atheists, an organization founded by the famous Madeline Murray O'Hare. Since 1994, Ms. Johnson has been the co-host of the cable television program The Atheist Viewpoint and has testified before the United States Commission on Civil Rights. She has been a frequent guest on shows like The O'Reilly Factor, Larry King Live, even a Barbara Walters special. The executive director of the Godless Americans Political Action Committee, Ellen Johnson, joins us by phone. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much. It's nice to be with you.
You're welcome. In our Spirit Square studio is Daniel Russell Pinson, the coordinator for Charlotte Atheists and Agnostics, an atheist for his entire adult life. He joined that organization last year. Thank you for joining us as well.
It's great to be here, Mike. Thank you.
And Daniel Dennett is the Austin B. Fletcher Professor of Philosophy and co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University. An atheist, he is the author of several books, among them Breaking the Spell, which suggests that neutral, scientifically informed education about every religion in the world should be mandatory in school. That should surprise some people. We'll talk about that this hour, I'm sure, and we welcome Dr. Dennett, who also joins us by phone. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
I'd like to begin with our guest in the studio, but I'd like the two of you on the phone also to answer this question. Given that all of us grew up in this religious society called the United States, which is the most religious nation in the world, at what point did you become an atheist or an agnostic, and why?
Well, I think first we have to talk about what does it mean to be an atheist, okay, and what does agnostic mean.
Okay.
And I think there's a lot of misconceptions about even what the words mean. And, of course, we can't come to any conclusion or even have discussion about it unless we have an agreement on what the terms mean.
So atheist means?
Well, the difference between atheism and agnosticism is the difference between belief and knowledge. So an agnostic is somebody without knowledge. So with respect to God, an agnostic is somebody who just simply does not have knowledge of God.
Therefore, they cannot affirm or deny the existence of a God.
Correct, because they simply do not have the knowledge.
Okay.
Now, I would argue that we are all agnostic with respect to God, because if we're very truthful with ourselves, we do not have knowledge of God. People might claim that they hear God. Mm-hmm. People might claim that they talk to God, or that God is, you know, present in their life, but I just don't think that really meets the criteria for the word knowledge, and it certainly wouldn't be acceptable in court, for instance. So I would argue that we're all agnostic. Now, the question is, what do you do about it? I don't have knowledge of God. Well, do I believe or do I not believe? And that's where the diversion
starts. So how do you identify? How do you self-identify, agnostic or atheist?
Well, for convenience sake, I identify as an atheist.
Because atheist means that you don't believe in God,
right?
Correct?
An atheist lacks the belief in God.
So at what point did you come to this belief and or lack of belief? I'm not sure how to describe it. At,
right.
At this decision to be an atheist.
I see it as a lack of belief, just for clarification.
Okay.
But
right.
I think we all start off life with a lack of belief. Nobody is born with a belief in a deity or any other concept like that. So I think we all start off in this neutral state, of lack of belief. We don't believe in
Zeus. Because we don't know anything when we're born. But
right. So I'm just saying,
so you have to. You are either taught a belief, or you were never taught a belief, or you are taught a belief and rejected a belief, and that's how you arrive at being an atheist or an agnostic. For which, what was your path? That's my question.
Well, I had an uneventful basic experience with the church growing up, like lots of other people did. I was on the church basketball team. I went to church camp, but I never had a gotcha moment where, you know, I felt a presence, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And as I grew older, and I've always been a science-based person. I've been a critical thinking person. And there's just nothing compelling about the arguments in my case. You have to think about all the other religions, you know, Islam, Judaism, et cetera. They all make the same or similar claims. They all have ancient texts that they use to back up those claims. Are they all right? Are they all wrong? You know, a person like me thinks they're probably all wrong.
Okay, let me bring Ellen Johnson and Dr. Daniel Dennett into this conversation. Are you on the same page with Dan Pinson here in the studio? Ellen?
Well, I'm not an agnostic. I'm an atheist. And, you know, I just think that when it comes to belief in a God, the probability that there is one is like 0.00000001. So it's clear that it's an idea that can just be tossed because the probability that one exists is just so remote. So it's just like, I'm not an agnostic towards, mermaids or fairies or gnomes or unicorns. So, you know, it's not my description.
And at what point point in your life did you arrive at that decision?
I've always been an atheist. I was reared in a secular home. My parents were not religious but I never heard the word atheist. Almost like, you know, like 30 years ago, you hardly heard the word homosexual either. But I never heard the word atheist. I didn't know what I was. I was surrounded by friends who were religious, Lutherans and Catholics, and I tried to understand what that was all about, so as much as I could. But it didn't make any sense for me. I tried to believe, I tried to think that there was a God, and it just didn't work for me.
Okay.
I just couldn't accept it.
And Dr. Dennett, are you on the same page here? You are self-described as an atheist, correct?
And of course we're all atheists about Thor and Jupiter and Baal and so forth. I mean, I don't know anybody who believes in those gods. I just go, as Richard Dawkins says, but I go one God further. I'm an atheist about them all. I went to Sunday school as a kid and learned a lot about Christian belief and read the Bible and sang in the choir and all that. But I suppose I was 12 or 13 when I began to think, well, this is all very nice, but it's just make-believe. And it wasn't a crashing, thundering moment for me. I just sort of realized that, oh, okay. So I wonder if these people actually believe what they're saying. And, of course, a lot of them don't. A lot of people, even ministers, they go through their lives doing good works, doing wonderful things, praying, doing the services, but they don't believe it.
So that was going to be my next question. Given the fact that it must be very difficult to be an atheist in this society, and certainly difficult to be an atheist who is out about it, because there's got to be significant social pressure not to talk about this or to go against the grain here, I was going to ask if you thought there are a lot more atheists than we know about who may be sitting in the pews. I wasn't going to go so far as to say standing in the pulpit, but you're saying that that's certainly possible.
Oh, sure. And, in fact, I get mail all the time from people acknowledging this and telling me thank you for making it possible for me to express to somebody, at least, yes, I'm an atheist. If I admitted that in my town, nobody would come to my dry cleaning shop or I'm a dentist. I'd lose half my dental patients. I live in Massachusetts in the Boston area, and it's very easy to be an atheist up here. But I know there's parts of the country where there's really a very strong social pressure against admitting it. And the atheists in those parts of the country are under the same sort of shadow that homosexuals used to be under, and of course in some places still are.
Madeline Murray O'Hare is possibly the most famous atheist in America, and when she would make herself known and appear on television shows, there was always a great hue and cry and great controversy about her beliefs and what she espoused and the arguments that she got in. She was still alive just a few years ago, but I remember these conversations, I think, from the 60s and 70s and possibly the 80s. Have things gotten easier over time? Is there more acceptance of this? Is there a laissez-faire attitude toward atheism and atheists, or is it just as difficult today? You live in Charlotte. Let's begin here, because there's a church on every corner here.
Right. Well, I don't know if I had the greatest feel for that. I've been an atheist for a very long time, but I haven't very much been active in the...
Until this past year.
Yeah, until this past year. You know, I made the decision about a year ago to be open about it, but I find myself not usually having the opportunity to be open about it. I mean, a lot of times religion doesn't necessarily come up.
Why do you want to be open about it?
Well, because I believe in the truth, and I want, and I see bad decisions being made, and I see what I see as the country going in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Based on religion?
Not totally based on religion, but based on irrationality, and I believe that things, if you're going to do something, you should have good reasons to do it.
Mm-hmm. Ellen Johnson, you're the president of American Atheists, which is the organization that Madeline Murray O'Hare founded. Are things more difficult, less difficult? Is there less resistance, more resistance? What do you say?
Well, I agree with Dr. Dennett. It depends on where you live. We're based in New Jersey, and it's pretty easy being an atheist here, and it's easy pretty much where he is, too. So it really does depend on where you live. And it also depends on whether or not you're in or out of the closet and how much. The theists don't so much care that we are atheists. What they care about is when we do something about it. When we file a lawsuit to stop them from doing something that's unconstitutional, that's when you have a problem. Other than that, they pretty much think that we're an anomaly, we're somebody to be saved, we're a challenge, something like that, and it can be quite amusing. But when you do something about it, when you stand up for your rights and say, no, I am not going to pray, in class here, or no, I'm not going to do that, that's when you do have a problem. But it's also, like you said, it's analogous to being a homosexual, like what the gays were going through, like 20 or 30 years ago. And I think the solution is to join a national organization so that there's strength in numbers and to come out of the closet so, you know, we can pretty much make it as many of us who can come out of the closet should come out of the closet. I mean, I don't want people to lose their jobs or be kicked out of their homes, which is what the gays went through. We all know what the gays have gone through and are still going through. And so, you know, a lot of people might be hesitant, but in so many instances, it's not what we atheists assume that there will be a problem when there's no evidence for it. So I think that they should at least test the waters, see what it's like, instead of spending their lives in the closet because they assume the worst will happen.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back more and explore this belief system, atheism and agnosticism, with our three guests. And we'll open the phones later in the program as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by the Charlotte Symphony. Christoph Perrick conducts a Brahms program with violinist Vivian Hagner, performing Brahms Violin Concerto and Symphony No. 4, February 2nd and 3rd at the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. And by the Foundation for the Carolinas, which holds its annual meeting February 15th, featuring Dr. Nancy Cantor, Chancellor of Syracuse University, who will discuss how shared stories build community. Tickets at fftc.org. Coming up tomorrow on this program, a closer look at something we've talked about before, chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome, which for years went unrecognized by the many members of the medical community. Well, now it has been recognized as legitimate by the Centers for Disease Control. This is a relatively new development, and it just so happens that the National CFIDS Association of America is headquartered here. We'll meet with their president and several medical experts and talk more about CFIDS tomorrow at 9.
Mayor Ray Nagin of New Orleans says he enlightened the billions being spent in Iraq. His city is being shortchanged. 17 months after Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast, we'll talk about the money, the logistics, and the will to rebuild New Orleans. The Diane Rehm Show, Wednesday.
That's this morning at 10 after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM WFAE.
See how area artists express their creativity and imagination in the Radiovision 2007 exhibit. This art competition takes radio out of its box and looks at WFAE's place in our lives. Join us at the Charlotte Art League Gallery on Camden Road, Friday, February 2nd, from 6 to 9 p.m. as we announce the winners. Information available at WFAE.org.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about atheism today with Ellen Johnson, the president of the American Atheists, Dr. Daniel C. Dennett, professor of philosophy and the co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University, and the author of several books on the topic, Breaking the Spell, Freedom Evolves, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, among them. And they're on the phone, and in our studio, Dan Russell Pinson, who is coordinator for the Charlotte Atheists and Agnostics. Given the fact that we live today in a kind of me society, can it be fairly argued that there may be atheists among you who are atheists simply because they don't want to admit the existence of something greater than themselves, something whose rules they must obey? Are there atheists who are atheists because they won't or don't want to subjugate their ego to something else? I don't know who should take the answer to that. Dan?
Oh, I'll take it.
Okay, Doctor.
Sure, this is Dan, Dan Dennett. Well, of course there are. And there are also deeply religious people on the outside who are just as selfish and mean as your described atheist. But I don't see that religion has a particularly benign effect on improving the proportions of people that are just selfish jerks. There's a lot of selfish jerks in the world, and religion doesn't seem to cure them. I do say this. I will grant this. At its best, religion can restore a sense of humility and a sense of purpose to people who've lost track of it. And this is a real, really good thing that religion can do. Other things can do it too. Religion can do that, and that's one of the reasons that I think that rather than trying to extirpate religion, trying to make it go extinct, we should try to simply let it evolve into more benign forms and get rid of some of the irrationality that cloaks it today.
Can I jump in here?
Sure, Ellen. Go ahead.
Your question was a version of what the theists say to us. What they say to us is, being an atheist allows you to commit all kinds of horrible acts because you don't think that there's a supreme being. Being an atheist means you don't have a higher power, so you can do anything you want. And what they're essentially saying is, you can accept all the liberal politics of our day, because it really doesn't come down to theology when the theists are talking to us. It comes down to the politics. Therefore, you will support homosexuality. You will reproductive rights for women, contraception, the morning after pill, abortions, anything that they don't like politically. They think we have a free license to engage in and even commit crimes, which of course there's no evidence for. Atheists are not, known for a higher crime rate than the rest of society. But the argument also takes the onus off the theist. The religious people who claim to have a moral superiority are out and about committing all kinds of crimes in all kinds of ways, and they don't want to focus on that or have to answer to that. So they turn the tables on us, and they try and turn their argument around and say, you just don't want to have to answer to anybody. You don't want to have to follow the rules. You don't want to have to do the right thing. And this gives you license to do whatever you want. That's basically the argument, and there's nothing to it.
And the answer is?
Absolutely. Yeah, the argument is, again, it's really to take the onus off the theist. Let's not concentrate. The theist is saying, let's not look at what we do, because we're hypocrites. We say one thing and we do another, and we can't justify that. Being religious, even professionally religious people like the priests aren't better because they're religious. Look at all the crimes that they commit against our children and all that. So they're saying, we don't want to look at that, so we're going to throw it back on the atheist. And we're going to put the atheist on the defensive and say, because you are an atheist, you don't have to follow a higher authority, and you don't want to follow a higher authority because you really want to do whatever you want, bad things. Of course, there's no evidence to that.
Well,
atheism is not a guarantee, however. It doesn't mean atheists don't commit crimes and don't, you know, do all kinds of things that aren't right. Atheists do break laws. It's not a guarantee. But we don't claim to have, you know, moral superiority, and we don't claim that atheism necessarily.
Well, our legal code in this and other Western nations seems to be predicated on the Judeo-Christian ethic, on the Ten Commandments, and some of the other laws.
No, it doesn't.
I have to disagree, too.
Why?
Well,
take
a look at the Ten Commandments. I mean, how many of the Ten Commandments are actually laws? Three or four at most. Do not steal.
And they violate the Bill of Rights. The one that, you know, if you cannot take the Lord's name in vain, that's violating our right to freedom of speech. The one that says you shall have no other God before me violates our right to freedom of religion. I mean, they're just the opposite of our Bill of Rights.
And it's just a kind of myth that's, if you say it enough, people start believing it. That's a campaign now of propaganda.
Well, most people would believe, and you correct me if they're wrong. I've never said that before. Most people believe that their sense of moral values, their moral code, comes from their religious belief. That's not true?
I disagree. I think a lot of times they say it comes from the Bible, but the Bible is far from a standard of moral and ethical.
So in the absence of a moral code that is religiously based, be it Islam, Islamically based, or Jewish, or Christian, or whatever, where does our moral code come from? How do we have morals?
It comes from the political consensus of reflective people over the centuries, over the last two millennia. Let's just look at Christianity for a moment. It's evolved tremendously. Not a single person in the United States would be comfortable living with the morality of the Old Testament or with the morality of Christianity in the first, say, millennium of its era. Over the centuries, we've changed our mind about what's a capital offense and what's a terrible crime and what's permissible. And so religion and the interpretation of the Bible has changed over the years, responding to the reflective opinions of people just deciding, no, we just don't believe that anymore. And it's the power, it's really a much more democratic ideal. It's the power of people getting together and talking it over and deciding what they want to live by. And that's our higher power, those of us who are secular. We do acknowledge the, not the absolute authority, but the default authority, the defeasible authority of the general sense of humankind about what the right things are to do.
And Dan has already talked in the studio about being a rational thinker and a scientific thinker, and that's one of the reasons that he came to the conclusion that he came to in his life. And Dr. Dennett, you are the co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies. I'm sure that you seek out rational thought patterns in what you do. Are the two of you saying then that religion is irrationally based?
Religion says that it's irrationally based. Of course it's irrationally based. That's what faith is all about. If you could prove it, it wouldn't be faith. It's something you're supposed to take independently of reason. That is at least irrational. And in fact, if you commit your life to it, it's irrational.
You're saying essentially that they can't prove, that there is no evidence and it can't be proven that there is a God. But if you can't, can you prove that there isn't one?
But I don't think the burden of proof is on us. We're not making a positive fact claim.
Doesn't that worry you a little bit?
Well, you can't prove the non-existence of this flying spaghetti monster.
Yes, but what if you're wrong?
Well, what if they're wrong about Islam? They're risking their eternal soul because they don't believe in Allah. I mean, everybody is risking something. But,
and I'm willing to risk my, you know, go ahead. You know, it's the old believe or burn threat that we get. Go ahead. I mean, I am willing to burn for my right to intellectual integrity, to think for myself. I mean, and even if there was a God, let me just throw this right out there. If a God walked into my office this morning, I wouldn't care. I would still continue to think for myself. I wouldn't start praying. I wouldn't attend church. I would still question authority. Any God who would allow airplanes to crash into the ocean, who would allow planes to fly into the World Trade Center, who would allow tsunamis to kill thousands of people, to rip children out of their parents' arms. I mean, who wants to worship a God or who would care? That God ought to show itself to me and start answering to us. Talk about, you know, believe or burn. That God has a lot to answer for. Why anybody would care about any gods? Everybody in this conversation and everybody listening to this conversation this morning, who is omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent, would prevent any child from getting cancer, would prevent anybody from dying in a car crash or any planes from crashing.
Now, the answer in the religious
community somehow is on a coffee break every time these things happen.
The answer in the religious community, I think, and I don't want to put words in their mouth about situations that you've just suggested, are that God has a plan that we do not have privy to. And that we just have to have faith that God is doing the right thing and that it will all be explained later on. Is that a bad argument?
God should just step aside and let human just take care of things. And that's, you know, we're talking
perhaps
that
he
there
has.
Are gods.
Well,
and this is, you know, this is
Ellen,
like,
Ellen, yes. Perhaps he has. Perhaps, I mean, some of the founding fathers believed, if I'm not mistaken, they believed in a God, but they didn't believe that he took an active role in the everyday lives of human beings. Perhaps
right,
he has stepped
theism.
Aside. Well, perhaps he has stepped aside.
Well, we're talking as if, you know, God, there was a God. The bottom line is there is no God, but I'm engaging in this conversation as if there was such a God. Mm. There isn't a God. Humans take care of humans. We solve our problems. We improve the world or it doesn't get done because we can see how well gods do. So, you know, that's why humans have to get involved. There aren't any gods and humans take care of each other.
Okay, let me go through some emails here that we've gotten over the course of this program so far. I have over the course of my 52 years proceeded from loose Catholicism to fundamentalist Jewish Christian cult, joined as a teen with my dad, to agnostic, to what I would say is a number 6 level atheist. I am atheistic about a supernatural presence at about the same level I am about the tooth fairy. I finally admitted that I cannot force myself to believe. I do not understand choosing to believe. Either one does or does not. I do not discuss this with anyone I know. I work in an office that is happily full of really practicing Christians, but I do feel it would be rude to discuss my recently developed position with them. Dr. Dan Dennett would say that I am a bright. Is that correct, doctor?
Yeah, that's right. And there's many out there like him.
What does that mean? What does that mean, a bright? That's Anna, by the way.
The term bright was not invented by me, but it was popularized somewhat by some things that I wrote. It was coined a few years back to mimic the great success that homosexuals had with the word gay. Find a nice, short, positive word. They chose bright, and use it to cover both atheists and agnostics, and use it as a focus for consciousness raising and for saying, giving people the sort of self-confidence, say, oh, look, oh, I'm a bright, in case you're interested. We don't have to go around shoving the fact that that's what we are into people's faces. We don't. The man who wrote this email is, he says he doesn't particularly want to be rude to his coworkers, and I think that's in general wise. But I think there's a time when he should risk rudeness by simply calling them if they say something just outrageous about atheists, which one hears all the time. It's still quite acceptable to call people godless and mean that in a very negative tone. Mm-hmm. And just say, you know, there may be people around here who would take offense at that remark. I think that staying in the closet for many people is wise, and certainly there's millions and millions of people in this country who've done that, and of course, lots of politicians.
Okay, can you be a politician and an atheist at the same time? Can you get elected?
Sure, but you just can't admit it. You can be a politician and a homosexual, and only a few have, like Barney Frank, have dared come out and admit it and be reelected. Times are changing, though. There's got to be lots of atheists in Congress. We've had atheist presidents. They just haven't admitted it.
Well, let me tell you how things are changing. As the executive director of the Godless Americans Political Action Committee, we were astounded last year at the number of politicians who asked for our endorsement. They came to us and they said, I'm running for Congress, I'm running for the Senate. These are probably people who you've never heard of, but they ran for Congress, they ran for Senate, they ran in local elections. They wanted to be able to say that the Godless Americans Political Action Committee endorsed their candidacy. And we were so amazed by that. I'd have to dig out the folder to come up with the names, but these people would not mind being named. We were very happy. So I see that there is progress, and in the next, for 2008, we'll see more people asking for our endorsement.
You want to jump in here?
So
Dan?
Things are changing.
Yeah, I think the email that we just read brings up an important point, which is that there is a double standard when it comes to religious belief. If this emailer said that she had a different view on the immigration issue or Bush's Iraq policy, she wouldn't think, oh, I better not say anything about it because it might be rude.
I think 2-3 years ago she would have.
Well, okay, but take any other, non-aggressive, okay. But when it comes to religion, that somehow that's off limits, and we have to ask ourselves, why is that? Why is religious belief off limits?
Isn't that one of the things that the so-called new atheists are advocating, that prohibition against speaking out against religion should be removed from the table?
Right, because if I come on the air and say that the Holocaust never existed, I would be pummeled with questions, and I would be, put to the wall to give all the proof and whatever, and I would be pretty much ostracized from the conversation. I mean, you wouldn't refer to me for any knowledge on European history or anything else for that matter. If I say Elvis is still alive, or UFOs landed on my backyard and picked me up and did experiments on me, you're going to, pin me to the wall and force me to give you all the proof I have, and if I don't, you're not going to believe me. But if I were to say anything like, I think the earth is 6,000 years old because the Bible tells me so, that's kind of off limits. You can't question me because that's part of my religious belief.
Dr. Dennett, I know you wanted to jump in here, but why does that happen? Why are people so against that kind of a conversation?
Well, this is one of the adaptations that has evolved in religion, which is this protective shield of don't ask about this. It's a little bit like don't ask, don't tell. It's a device for deflecting criticism and making people feel guilty about even raising the issue. It's interesting that this has been a feature of religions going back thousands and thousands of years. Today's religions are, of course, just the survivors of many, probably hundreds of thousands of religions which have vanished without a trace. The ones that have survived are the ones that have had the best defense mechanism built right into them.
We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by Dr. James Altizer and the Vein Center of Charlotte, providing state-of-the-art outpatient treatment for varicose and spider veins. Trust the vein specialists, 704-341-1122. And by Executive MBA Weekend, evening and global programs at UNC for working professionals, presenting an information session in Charlotte Wednesday, February 7th, registration at 1-877-UNC-E-MBA. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Reams Show, speaking to a Senate committee this week, Mayor Ray Nagin of New Orleans pointed to the billions of dollars being spent in Iraq and said that his city is being shortchanged. 17 months after Hurricane Katrina, Diane and her guests talk about the recovery efforts, why they are moving so slowly, the fate of the city's displaced residents, and how best to move forward. And then in the 11 o'clock hour, recent research demonstrates how our brains can change both in structure and in function. A review of recent neurological research and its remarkable confluence with centuries-old Buddhist thought. The guest is Sharon Begley, a science columnist for the Wall Street Journal and co-author of Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain. That's coming up later on this morning here on the Diane Rehm Show. We have a loaded bank of phone calls. We will get to you coming up immediately following the next 60 seconds. Stay with us.
When it comes to presidential primaries, California wants to be first.
We shouldn't let New Hampshire and Iowa steal the stage. Let's make California worth something.
And in New Hampshire?
Be very careful if you want to slice this out of the pie, because we do a big job here in sorting down the people that go through.
California's early primary efforts later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 here on 90.7 FM WFAE.
Next time on The World, the 1918 flu pandemic killed 50 million people, including hundreds of thousands of Americans.
Those people who died, died miserable deaths.
But six U.S. communities made it through the pandemic with no deaths. Medical historians have now learned how those communities did it. I'm Lisa Mullins. Survival Lessons from 1918, next time on The World, tonight at 7 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In our studio, Dan Russell Pinson, coordinator of Charlotte Atheists and Agnostics, Agnostics. On our phone, the president of American Atheist, Ellen Johnson, and Dr. Daniel C. Dennett, professor of philosophy and the co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University, also an atheist and the author of several books on the topic, Breaking the Spell, Freedom Evolves, Darwin's Dangerous Idea among them. We are loaded down with phone calls and with emails. Let's go right to the telephones. Oh, that's exciting. Gail, welcome to the program.
Hello. It's nice to talk to y'all. I wanted to make a comment. You guys had been talking earlier about how atheists don't have like a written text or a set of beliefs on which to base their morals, and I think that the moral system for atheists can come from like evolved traits, and I do believe in evolution, or I accept evolution rather, and I think that over time the evolution has selected for people to just be nice and decent to each other, because if you're nice and decent to each other, you don't, you know. Why?
Gail, are you do you self-identify as an atheist?
In certain circles, yes. It's difficult. I am a teacher, so I try to. Well, really hide my beliefs because I don't want to influence my students or in the community that I live in. Atheism is really, really looked down on. So
Because of our telephone echo problem, I'm going to let you go, Gail, but I want to have our guest comment on what you just said about having to be in the closet because you're a teacher. That's not just a moral issue. That's a freedom of existence issue in this country, is it not? Isn't that one of the things that you're trying to stamp out, this prejudice against people who espouse no belief in God?
Yeah, and you know, it was nice to hear from Gail, but that's something that just pretty much takes time. You can't change people's ideas overnight. Look at blacks, the black community in America. They're still facing discrimination. Gays are going to face discrimination for a long time. It really just, you know, it's almost like a generation of bigoted ideas have to die off so that, you know, things can change. And the laws have to change. It's very important to join again. I mean, as president of a national organization, we file lawsuits to keep the state and church separate wherever and however we can to protect our rights as we come out of the closet so that we don't face harassment, discrimination, or anything like that, and so that the religious don't get special rights through such legislation. So that helps, too.
Are there protections based in law in this country for atheists who are discriminated against in the workplace or at school or elsewhere?
If you're facing like employment discrimination, you know, that's not really an Establishment Clause issue unless it comes from the law. Unless, for instance, the religious have been trying to pass legislation that died in the 108th Congress, which would allow religious groups who receive federal funding to discriminate handing out that funding. So they want the right to be able to discriminate. So if we can you know, prevent laws like that from being passed, that's helpful. But oftentimes atheists, it's back, it's analogous to being gay. Atheists will be fired, and they know why. They know it's because they were an atheist, but you can't really prove it. Just like, you know, sexism or ageism or anything right. like that. You know why. So oftentimes they need to see an attorney who deals with labor laws or, I mean, employment discrimination.
All right, let me go to the telephone again. Let me go to Spencer in Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Graham.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. Humanity is in and of itself a religious entity. There are Jews, there are Christians, there are Buddhists, there are Islam, and there are atheists. Atheism is a religion in and of itself because there's a belief that there's no supreme entity. How do these guys rationalize pushing their religion off on the rest of society by filing the lawsuits that clear out the public square?
Okay, Spencer, because of our echo problem, I'm going to get your answer off the air. Thank you for your call. Would you first of all agree with him that atheism is a religion?
Absolutely not.
I would bet you're going to turn around the conversation here. He asks you how you could push your religion down the throats of others by filing lawsuits, and the lawsuits are against people who are trying to push religion down people's throats.
Well, that's exactly right. Well, I mean, we can go down two paths here, but, I mean, first of all, if you're going to call atheism religion, well, let's define what a religion is.
Okay.
I mean, religions have certain traits. I think the first and foremost trait of a religion is the belief in a supernatural being. But by being an atheist, by definition, we don't believe in supernatural beings. We don't have sacred objects. We don't have sacred texts. We don't do ritual acts. We don't get our morals from ancient religious texts. So by any property of religion, atheism just doesn't fit the bill. Now, as far as lawsuits go, well, it's called the Constitution. And the Founding Fathers were wise enough to create a secular constitution where there is a separation of church and state. And America is built for everybody, not just particular specific interests.
You know, some prominent atheists have suggested that religion is an outmoded social construct and should be retired from the field. That's not likely to happen. But Dr. Durrett, in an article in U.S. News and World Report in which that comment came, you are quoted as being willing to extend a conciliatory hand to believers so long as they are willing to subject any purported God-given moral edict to the full light of reason, using all the evidence at our command. Is that because you believe that that isn't possible to achieve, or do you actually believe that is possible to achieve?
I see some religions that, or one might call them former religions. There are some religions that are remarkably reasonable and open. The Unitarian Universalists is the obvious case. So let's talk about them for a moment. I've actually given a couple of sermons in Unitarian churches, and these are organizations that exist for fellowship, for communion of spirit among themselves, and for doing good works, and for keeping alive traditions of various benign sorts. And if more religions could become like that, I think that would be fine. They're reasonable. They're every item of their creed is open to criticism and skepticism. So it's entirely possible.
All of you, I think, at one time or another in this conversation, have alluded to some of the things that religion has caused to happen in the world, and some atheists believe that religion continues to do great harm to society, aside from the many wars waged in God's name or in the defense of some religious principle. Give me some other ways that you see religion as being harmful.
Well, for me as a father, I am very concerned about the intelligent design versus evolution controversy and the religion versus science attack as a whole.
Okay.
I think that the whole end times rapture push is extraordinarily dangerous. This is encouraging people not to plan for the future, not to think about how this planet is going to get through the next century or the next five centuries. It licenses really irresponsible policy, and may well even license irresponsible and dangerous and reckless policy and foreign policy.
And I would imagine that you would include in that people who would say you need to live your life for the reward ahead in heaven.
You know, this is, I'm always amazed that people take this so seriously. That is such an ignoble modification. This is the reason to be good on this earth is for the reward in the afterlife. That's Santa Claus won't give you any presents unless you're really good. Well, how about just being good because you want to be good? How about just being good because you're proud to be good, and it doesn't matter that you're going to have eternal
reward? This will puzzle some people who are devout believers of whatever faith. They are devout believers, and they do good because God says you must do good, do unto others. And they have real trouble understanding how somebody who has no belief in a God would feel any responsibility to do unto others as you would have done unto you, because there's no punishment in the afterlife and there's no great reward in the afterlife. So what is the motivation of a non-believer?
Notice there's two really distinct motivations that you mentioned. One is reward in the afterlife, and the other is simply living up to an ideal set by, say, Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus wants you to be good. That's a reason in and of itself for many people. It's not that Jesus is going to reward me for being good. It's just that I admire and respect the moral code of, and it might not be Jesus. It might be somebody else. It might be Gandhi. It might be Martin Luther King, the person. And you say, this has inspired me to be good. You don't have to be religious to be inspired in this way. The idea that being good depends on reward in heaven is, I think, a cheapening of that other, much better idea.
Tom in Albemarle writes, funny how our great tolerant country is so blasé about atheists and agnostics staying in the closet. I am an agnostic, he says. Anyway, your lead-in about having neutral religious curriculum in schools piqued my interest. How about religion and moral philosophy all being regular curriculum in our public schools? That stems from my comment in the beginning that you, Dr. Dennett, advocate or have advocated that neutral, scientifically informed education about every religion in the world should be mandatory. Why should that be?
Because knowledge is the best protection against fanaticism. As I look around the world, and every religion, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism, if you look around the world, you see that all of the small sects that are dangerous, wherever you see dangerous fanaticism, it thrives on, it depends on the enforced ignorance of the young. If we can just have, in addition to the three R's, have a fourth R, religion, where everybody, homeschoolers, people going to religious schools, public schools, private schools, there's a curriculum on the world's religions, just facts about their creeds, about their history, about their prohibitions, their requirements, their music, their art, their tradition. I think that if this were a part of the curriculum and every child got to see what these other religions were like and also got to see facts about their own religion, just plain facts about the history of their own religion, this would do wonders. Any religion that could thrive under that regime would deserve to thrive. And the religions that would go extinct would be good riddance to them.
The problem is the right-wing religious people in America don't want that, for the very fact that they don't want their children to be taught about other religions.
And they're wrong.
And when their religion is taught about, they want to whitewash it. They want to selectively teach the dogmas, the tenets, the history of their religions. And until we should have atheists teach these classes, because we will give an impartial teaching of the histories, the dogmas, the tenets of all the religions. But you see, that would not be good to Christianity, the major religion in this country. So that's one reason why they want their religion taught, and that's why they're pushing just to have their religion taught and not, you know, comparative religion.
Here's something that that we haven't really talked about. It's another email from Nancy who says, when the spiral of a snail's shell, a sunflower's petals, and the swirl of the Milky Way galaxy all have precisely the same mathematical coordinates, check out Fibonacci, how can you deny the existence of at least a master plan?
That's easy. The mathematics of the universe is eternal, and it doesn't need any. It didn't need to be created.
It's just happenstance. Just happenstance. It just happened.
Well, as opposed to what was created, nobody laid down the laws of mathematics. Nobody had to lay down the fact that 2 + 2 = 4, or that P and not P, a contradiction, that can't be true. That's just the structure of everything. It's not something that had to be brought into existence. It didn't have to be legislated. It didn't have to be planned. It just is.
Regardless
of what the shell, how the shell is formed, and regardless of the mathematics of the sunflower petals or any of that, it's still not proof of a designer. It's still not proof that there was a creator. It's still not proof that a God made it happen.
In the absence of a creator, is there a void in your life? I mean, why live? What's the purpose of a life well lived? What's the purpose of existence if there is nothing after this? If this is all there is, as Peggy Lee would say, is that all there is? What's the point?
But look at how wonderful it is. Look at this great, wonderful planet. It's so beautiful, and there's so many wonderful things that thousands of people and millions of people have created over the centuries. There's a tremendous amount of goodness in this world. And I, for one, am very grateful to be alive, and I feel an obligation to give back, to try to contribute to this wonderful stock of goodness that there is in the world. That's enough.
Ellen?
Well, it's curious at how at the end, when our lives are coming to an end, the theists fight to stay alive just like the rest of us. There's that will to live. If they think that there's something better, something more beautiful, something more wonderful, why is it that they resist death with everything they've got just like the rest of us? Because we know instinctually that there is nothing else. We don't make the rules. We atheists aren't making the rules. It is what it is.
Dan Pinson, go ahead.
Well, atheists have the intellectual freedom to, you know, handle real-world issues without having to reconcile ancient theology. We realize this is the only life we have, and we better live it to the fullest.
I wish we had more time. We have a full bank of phone calls. I have about 20 emails here in a stack that I have not gotten to yet, but we're out of time, and I thank you all for joining us. Dr. Daniel C. Dennett, professor of philosophy at Tufts University, author of Breaking the Spell, Freedom Evolves, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Ellen Johnson, president of American Atheists, and Dan Russell Pinson, coordinator of Charlotte Atheists and Agnostics. I'm Mike Collins.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Bradsherky. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Our research assistant is Aaron Sutton. The intern is Greg Gavin. And the engineer is Joey Sprinkle. For more information about this show, or to listen to archive editions of the show, or learn more about our free podcast, go to WFAE.org.
Charlotte Talks made possible in part today by 123NC.com. Instant access to North Carolina criminal records and nationwide background checks. Criminal records can be searched instantly online at 123NC.com. And by Time Warner Cable Business Class, offering Metro Ethernet solutions for enterprise businesses. A scalable and secure network dedicated to business. Time Warner Cable Business Class at charlotte.twcbc.com.
If you haven't tuned in to Morning Edition lately, you've missed former President Clinton.
I've never even discussed this with anybody before.
Iraq's President Jalal Talabani.
Syria, Iran, Turkey, we are asking them to stop.
Pervez Musharraf, the President of Pakistan.
They are all fools that they don't even know that there's a headquarter of Taliban there.
I'm Renee Montaigne. World Leaders Talk. We hope you're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Mike Collins. For years, those who suffered from a condition called chronic fatigue immune deficiency syndrome did so with the extra burden of having to convince spouses, bosses, friends, even some members of the medical community that their disease was real and not imaginary. Now the Centers for Disease Control has recognized CFIDS as legitimate. The National CFIDS Association of America is headquartered in Charlotte. We'll talk to them about what this recognition means and get a medical update on the condition when Charlotte talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Winter storm watch in effect tomorrow. 1 to 3 inches of snow and ice accumulation. Stay with us. We'll keep you informed tomorrow. It's WFAE Charlotte, WFHE Hickory, your NPR news source broadcasting in high-definition digital radio.